So we continue tonight in the second chapter of the Life Divine. The two negations, the materialist denial. So from the first chapter, where Sri Aurobindo titled it, above even the title of the chapter, the affirmations of Vedanta, we're dealing with these negative appraisals of the world. But we want to arrive at an affirmation of all. We want to find a way that permits us to reconcile the base of matter with the height of the spirit by using all the link worlds in between as the means of connection that requires us to come to a greater knowledge, that requires us not to choose one over the other, but rather to find a luminous reconciliation that brings them all together. All the worlds, the height of the spirit, the plinth of matter. If we choose only one, then eventually we are pushed to recognize the other. It's the great utility of knowledge. So with this opening thesis, Sri Aurobindo has arrived where we left off with a single sentence paragraph. Let's read it again. Therefore, the time grows ripe and the tendency of the world moves towards a new and comprehensive affirmation in thought and in inner and outer experience, and to its corollary, a new and rich self-fulfillment in an integral human existence for the individual and for the race. So this carries us beyond the limits of the Mayavada, beyond the limits of 19th century materialism, and poises humanity at the verge of the discovery of a new kind of knowledge. So let's begin with this next paragraph. From the difference in the relations of spirit and matter to the unknowable which they both represent, there arises also a difference of effectiveness in the material and the spiritual negations. This term, the unknowable, which is beyond the province of the investigation of the senses of physical science, which is beyond what religion thinks it can say about a divine being, is an idea that arises with Herbert Spencer. This term, the unknowable, enters into the stream of philosophy with him in the late 19th century. The idea that there are ultimate principles which cannot be explained because they're beyond the reach of the human mind. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. It means that they can't be placed into rational terminology. Whatever exists, whatever pre-exists in the unknowable is simply not ken, K-E-N, to human speech. So we're here dealing with the relations of spirit and matter. And this unknowable is that which is beyond, in a sense, both. So this polarity of being does not include the examination of the unknowable. Rather, when we focus on one or the other, we are led to it, to that which is indefinable, to that which exists behind. Exists is not even a fair word to use in philosophy, because exists means to stand out. And we're talking about something that is beyond the power of existence, which is already an expression of isness. So whatever that is or is not, we can't speak it, we can't define it, we can't draw a picture of it. So he's speaking about the difference of the effectiveness in this sentence between the two poles of negation, the material and the spiritual. The denial of the materialist, although more insistent and immediately successful, more facile in its appeal to the generality of mankind, is yet less enduring, less effective, finally, than the absorbing and perilous refusal of the ascetic. For it carries within itself its own cure. Materialism carries its own cure within its very method of process. Its most powerful element is the agnosticism which, admitting the unknowable behind all manifestation, extends the limits of the unknowable until it comprehends all that is merely unknown. So you have this idea of this barrier being pushed back, and more comes into the ken of knowledge. Just as we touched upon what the unknowable means philosophically, we have also to pause for a moment and look at what agnosticism means. This was a fairly recent term in usage in the late 19th, early 20th century. It arrives with T.H. Huxley, who was a strong devotee, disciple, you might say, of Darwin. And his simple thesis is that we should suspend belief when evidence is insufficient to support it. So if you have no evidence that something exists, you have no right, no method of knowledge by which to say it is true. So that is agnosticism. So as you gain more data, as you gain more knowledge, then you can say more. But Sri Aurobindo, of course, is finding this is quite a useful thing. This is part of the cure for a merely materialistic view of the world. Its premise is that the physical senses are our sole means of knowledge, and that reason, therefore, even in its most extended and vigorous flights, cannot escape beyond their domain. It must deal always and solely with the facts which they provide or suggest, and the suggestions themselves must always be kept tied to their origins. We cannot go beyond. We cannot use them as a bridge leading us into a domain where more powerful and less limited faculties come into play, and another kind of inquiry has to be instituted. There are echoes of this approach, of course, in modern psychology. If you only accept that the data gathered by the physical senses are valid, then how do you get to what is superphysical? How do you get to what is beyond material? If we accept that framework, then we'll never be able to work outside our material moorings. But Sri Aurobindo doesn't feel that that is a final resting place, even for physical science, because if its purpose is to inquire, as he said in the first chapter, then to inquire sufficiently means to go to the next level, to keep pushing beyond, not to rest only with that. Whatever is legitimate demands inquiry. So he begins with the next paragraph. A premise so arbitrary pronounces on itself its own sentence of insufficiency. It can only be maintained by ignoring or explaining away all that vast field of evidence and experience which contradicts it, denying or disparaging noble and useful faculties, active consciously or obscurely, or at worst latent in all human beings, and refusing to investigate superphysical phenomena except as manifested in relation to matter and its movements and conceived as a subordinate activity of material forces. Very interesting. You may know of Frederick Myers, who was a profound psychologist in the 19th century. Had a huge impact on William James and began to amass in the most rigorous scientific methods available to him, data relating to what might be possible for consciousness beyond the grip of the physical senses. And he interviewed hundreds and thousands of people and made minute observations and thought very lucidly about this. And it's possible that some of his ideas were present in England at the time Sri Aurobindo was there. So I refer you to Mr. Myers, and hope you have happy reading and make a glad acquaintance of his work. He's certainly worth going back and seeing. Ah, I found my place. As soon as we begin to investigate the operations of mind and of supermind in themselves and without the prejudgment that is determined from the beginning to see in them only a subordinate term of matter, we come into contact with a mass of phenomena which escape entirely from the rigid hold, the limiting dogmatism of the materialist formula. What he's suggesting, of course, is that we should be able to explore these inner worlds, which he calls supraphysical, with the inner tools that we possess in our own psyche, which are available to our psychological being. Supraphysical, by the way, is a term that means above the physical. As he was discussing the terms of existence earlier, matter, life, mind, supermind, leading to spirit, which we'll discover has a certain connotation to him, we see that all of these are stacked, in a sense, above and behind the other. That behind or within matter exists a world of life, but you can say as well that it is above, supraphysical, above the level of the physic. And above the level of the vital, the life power, is mind. And above the level of the mind is the supermind. All of these discoverable regions, lands, continents within ourselves, each distinguishable from the other. And while they may have an impact upon our physical senses, we may be able to distinguish and derive their influence upon us through the experience of the body. Nevertheless, Sri Aurobindo's point is that in our inner life, we can assay those worlds in and of themselves without reference back to the body. In other words, we can unchain ourselves from the physical consciousness and live freely and securely within those worlds without reference back. So, if that is true, then there are inner means, correct, by which we can measure those planes of being. That's where he's taking us with this paragraph. And the moment we recognize, as our enlarging experience compels us to recognize, that there are in the universe knowable realities beyond the range of the senses, and in man powers and faculties which determine rather than are determined by the material organs through which they hold themselves in touch with the world of the senses, that outer shell of our true and complete existence, the premise of materialistic agnosticism disappears. We are ready for a large statement and an ever-developing inquiry. We are not simply by going into the superphysical realms, leaving behind the realms of apprehendable being. These are worlds that we can know in the way that we know the physical world, but with inner organs, as it were, with modalities of consciousness, which become apparent to us when we're in those states. When we're locked in the physical consciousness, we guess at what they might be. We have remote hints, but we don't live in them securely. To get into that requires us to outgrow our moorings in this physical, materialistic method of approaching nature and self. He continues, but first it is well that we should recognize the enormous, the indispensable utility of the very brief period of rationalistic materialism through which humanity has been passing. For that vast field of evidence and experience which now begins to reopen its gates to us can only be safely entered when the intellect has been severely trained to a clear austerity. Seized on by unripe minds, it lends itself to the most perilous distortions and misleading imaginations, and actually in the past encrusted a real nucleus of truth with such an accretion of perverting superstitions and irrationalizing dogmas that all advance in true knowledge was rendered impossible. It became necessary for a time to make a clean sweep at once of the truth and its disguise in order that the road might be clear for a new departure and a surer advance. The rationalistic tendency of materialism has done mankind this great service. So while it may seem to have cauterized the human mind and the human spirit, it in a sense swept aside obscurantism, the kind of religiosity which buried us in superstition, an occultism that was ungrounded against the physical world. And so, in this way, it's done us a real good. It's allowed us to get clear of that so that if we come back to these fields of the superphysical and wish to explore them again, we don't have all of that baggage to carry with us. We travel lightly, we look with a sharper mind, with a more austere spirit, and gain evidence thereby, which will be more useful to us. And continuing to the next paragraph, for the faculties that transcend the senses by the very fact of their being enmeshed in matter, missioned to work in a physical body, put in harness to draw one car along with the emotional desires and nervous impulses, are exposed to a mixed functioning in which they are in danger of illuminating confusion rather than clarifying truth. Especially is this mixed functioning dangerous when men with unchastened minds and unpurified sensibilities attempt to rise into the higher domains of spiritual experience. In what regions of unsubstantial cloud and semi-brilliant fog, or a murk visited by flashes which blind more than they enlighten, do they not lose themselves by that rash and premature adventure? An adventure necessary indeed in the way in which nature chooses to effect her advance, for she amuses herself as she works, but still, for the reason, rash and premature. So Sri Aurobindo allows himself a little burst of humor. So this is the thing that he will be wrestling with in the life divine. How to bring those higher faculties of consciousness into sure functioning with the body without thereby being diminished in the immixture. If mind is always dulled by its material encasement, if the supermind is slowed by the tardy advance of the body's consciousness, then how sure can we be about the advancement of knowledge and other fields of human endeavor, the transformation of self, the transformation of society? So this will ever be a concern of Sri Aurobindo's, to ensure that the marriage between the highest energies and consciousnesses and their brand, you might say, in the body will be of the highest kind. Without that, we're doomed to the sorts of failure that have visited the human endeavors in the past. So on to the next now. It is necessary, therefore, that advancing knowledge should base herself on a clear, pure, and disciplined intellect. Well, that's necessary for science of any kind, whether it's a physical science or a psychological science or a spiritual science. It is necessary, too, that she should correct her errors sometimes by a return to the restraint of sensible fact, the concrete realities of the physical world. The touch of earth is always reinvigorating to the son of earth, even when he seeks a superphysical knowledge. It may even be said that the superphysical can only be really mastered in its fullness, to its heights we can always reach, when we keep our feet firmly on the physical. Earth is his footing, says the Upanishad, whenever it images the self that manifests in the universe. And it is certainly the fact that the wider we extend and the surer we make our knowledge of the physical world, the wider and surer becomes our foundation for the higher knowledge, even for the highest, even for the Brahma Vidya. So he was citing two different Upanishads, the Mundaka and the Brihadaranyaka. This theme that however high the consciousness might aspire, whatever great spaces it may occupy above, the feet must always be on the earth. We must connect the poles, and the higher we go, the deeper, therefore, we should be able to go. So this is a suggestion that he'll be following up, because if we get into superphysical ranges of consciousness, if we get into what he would call the superconscient, that which is beyond even the highest of the mind worlds and planes, we should therefore have a brilliance and a power that penetrates more deeply into matter, because what is it from which matter comes? There are connotations all through this chapter that will bear fruit in later chapters, and we will spend pages and pages, paragraphs and paragraphs, sentences and sentences, digging into precisely what he means. What is the superconscient? What is the inconscient? Will be of great cosmological and metaphysical concern to us. And it's just ahead. So we're to the paragraph that begins in emerging now. In emerging, therefore, out of the materialistic period of human knowledge, we must be careful that we do not rashly condemn what we are leaving or throw away even one tittle of its gains before we can summon perceptions and powers that are well grasped and secure to occupy their place. Rather, we shall observe with respect and wonder the work that atheism has done for the divine, and admire the services that agnosticism has rendered in preparing the illimitable increase of knowledge. In our world, error is continually the handmaid and pathfinder of truth, for error is really a half-truth that stumbles because of its limitations. Often it is truth that wears a disguise in order to arrive unobserved near to its goal. Well, if it could always be, as it has been in the great period we are leaving, the faithful handmaid, severe, conscientious, clean-handed, luminous within its limits, a half-truth and not a reckless and presumptuous aberration. So Sri Aurobindo is willing to do full honor even to systems of knowledge or philosophic perspectives which are antagonistic to his own. They have a utility. Agnosticism breaks down the barriers to what was previously unknown. We learn more and more through those methods. The advance of materialism has pushed away from us unhealthy types of spiritual science, if you even want to call them fields of knowledge by calling them science. And so they have turned into aids and allies in certain areas of our seeking. But we expect science, therefore, physical science especially, to be an honest agent, to not give in to its own prejudices, but to inquire fully and fairly. And I have to say that Sri Aurobindo, writing this 100 years ago, might be, I would say that I would be disheartened to see that actually there is the same tone, the same unwillingness to examine a phenomena beyond the range of the senses as before. And the great debate which currently rages in philosophic circles is still between the reality of consciousness independent of matter and that which sees consciousness as only an extrapolant, as an epiphenomenon of matter. T.H. Huxley's view that the mind is simply an epiphenomena of matter, all of its mentations being that, still has the loudest voice in modern psychology, notwithstanding the school of transpersonal psychology, which is an element, which is an agent for progress. But we have to see things as they are. So perhaps we need to press feet to the fire, as we say, and demand of physical science that it truly be scientific, not married to its presumptions, but free to explore anything which demands our attention. So to continue, a certain kind of agnosticism is the final truth of all knowledge. For when we come to the end of whatever path, The universe appears as only a symbol or an appearance of an unknowable reality which translates itself here into different systems of values, physical values, vital and sensational values, intellectual, ideal, and spiritual values. So mark that. The universe, he's saying, is a symbol of the unknowable. The more that, with a capital T, which is the unknowable behind all the staircase of existence, the more it is seen to be always beyond defining thought and beyond formulating expression. Mind attains not there, nor speech, says the Kena Upanishad. And yet, as it is possible to exaggerate with the illusionist the unreality of the appearance, so it is possible to exaggerate the unknowableness of the unknowable. To back up that phrase, the more it is seen to be always beyond defining thought, that points to the eventual failure of materialism. Because if we follow to discover that which is beyond defining thought, we find, and when we find, we know with a capital K. So knowledge leads us beyond the limited into the infinite, beyond the defined, beyond the distinct, into that which is united and one and yet undefinable. So remember that he has earlier in the chapter said that this is a dangerous negation which spiritualism throws against the world, denying it as an illusory thing that we perceive with our senses, but actually only spirit exists. So this sentence we'll come back to. And yet, as it is possible to exaggerate with the illusionists the unreality of the appearance, the world may seem to be apparently unreal, so it is possible to exaggerate the unknowableness of the unknowable. We can know, in a sense, is what he's going to say. When we speak of it as unknowable, we mean really that it escapes the grasp of our thought and speech. Instruments which proceed always by the sense of difference and express by the way of definition. So you might look at the mind as approaching a plate of food, and it can't eat the whole thing at once, so it has to carve something up and place that little bit in its mouth. A little piece at a time. If it comes into a room, it says, okay, that's a wall, that's a wall, that's a floor, that's a chair, but can't speak the whole thing at once, can't find the word that would define everything at once. And then there's that thing which is behind all of this. What is this thing which supports all this? The space in which all of this exists. And what is that behind space, which supports space and all the things that occupy it? There are no words. Since words describe and differentiate, since words speak to us of separate realities, there is no word for the person until he learns to say, me and you. But there's no word that connects the two. There is, no, I'm getting ahead of myself. But if not knowable by thought, It is attainable by a supreme effort of consciousness. So if we can't grasp the unknowable through the reach of our senses, of our mind, based upon our senses, we can come into a kind of knowledge of it through what we would call tapas in Sanskrit, through the application of consciousness, concentrating upon itself, concentrating in this case upon that. Then we can break through walls through this supreme effort of consciousness and arrive at a kind of knowledge. There is, even Sri Aurobindo writes, a kind of knowledge which is one with identity and by which, in a sense, it can be known. Note the capital I of it, the capital I in identity, the capital K in knowledge. Of course, many times he uses a capital K in looking at knowledge. But with the identity, he's suggesting that this truer knowledge, which leads you to understand what that is, to stand under what that is by means of identification. You become that, or you recognize your inherent unity with it, or your inherent oneness with it. It never was different than you. The senses may have described it as so, but the senses aren't the fullest truth. They're the variability of the one, but this is the essential one, you see. Certainly, that knowledge cannot be reproduced successfully in the terms of thought and speech, but when we have attained to it, the result is a revaluation of that in the symbols of our cosmic consciousness, not only in one, but in all the ranges of symbols, which results in a revolution of our internal being and through the internal of our external life. So this method of knowledge, this epistemology, which he's beginning to touch upon here, calls us into a transcendence of division. And in that transcendent consciousness, he is suggesting that the cosmic consciousness grasps the symbolism of the universe. So, by dint of being transcendent, you've pushed to the side the prison of an individual only awareness. You don't have simply one perspective. You have a perspective, if you want to call it a vision at all, which is all-embracing, which is established in oneness. And upon that is appended the symbol of the cosmos. The cosmic consciousness arises most securely when we have achieved this spiritual oneness, this transcendent awareness. So it's beautiful to see Sri Aurobindo, with just a few brush strokes, paint this enormous picture, because he's established that that which is behind all, is approachable and knowable by identity. You cannot know it in the way that you can know that an apple is different from an orange. You can't know it through that kind of discriminating knowledge, which we affirm is the method of the scientific mind. But you can know it by identifying your deep consciousness with that. And through that, you come to understand, to stand under the world, in a sense, to include all of that, to have an englobing consciousness. And then, with that awareness, when you look at all that is iterated in the universe, you see each as a symbol of that thing, a moving symbol. It is a dynamic, moving, imaginative reality that is extruded from, you might say, or expressed by this undefinable that. So you know it, capital IT, in a way that is profounder than mental knowledge. It's not a knowledge you acquire by books. It's not a knowledge that you acquire through the disquisition of reason. It is not sequential. It is sudden. It is enlightenment, simple. And the last section of that sentence, we also should not ignore. A revolution of our internal being and through the internal of our external life. Because when you see the world differently, you live in the world differently. When you've undergone a revolution within your own being and you live from the inside out, then nevermore can outside realities dominate and secure all your attention and drive you. Rather, you live from the internal realities, and they shape the outer environment more and more until eventually there is a conquest. We're coming to that. We may not get to it tonight, but the closing sentences of this chapter are quite luscious. So this is key to a life revolution, or a transformation, if you will, this change of awareness, this new kind of knowledge, which leads us beyond the perimeters of science. Moreover, there is also a kind of knowledge through which that does reveal itself by all these names and forms of phenomenal existence, which to the ordinary intelligence only conceal it. It is this higher but not highest process of knowledge to which we can attain by passing the limits of the materialistic formula and scrutinizing life, mind, and supermind in the phenomena that are characteristic of them, and not merely in those subordinate movements by which they link themselves to matter. Again, this is a suggestion that Sri Aurobindo will be following up in great detail later, because he's inviting us into the interior regions of the universe. This is speaking to the supraphysical worlds behind and above matter, life, mind, supermind, known in a way that is not accessible to the physical senses. It's true that supermind, mind, and life do, in a sense, dwell within the physical body. Even supermind is concealed in us now. It has to evolve, to emerge. But we cannot know those worlds above as they are simply by measuring them according to the way we are here. What can we know about the power of life from the casement of the body in which we sit, which is placed? We can know about the life that's present in this body. But if we were vaulted into the awareness of life in its own field, in the worlds of prana, our experience of prana would be entirely different than that parceled out in this little physical shell. No? So too with the mind, groping for knowledge, but mind in its own right is capable of receiving great illumination from above. But is it so in the body? With difficulty. Not with that ease and facility that it owns in its own spheres. That suggests to us how much we have to do, how far yet we have to go. So let's see if we can get another paragraph in. The unknown is not the unknowable. Other is that than the known. Also, it is above the unknown, says the Kena Upanishad, a continuation of that earlier citation. It need not remain the unknown for us unless we choose ignorance or persist in our first limitations. For to all things that are not unknowable, all things in the universe, there correspond in that universe faculties which can take cognizance of them. And in man, the microcosm, these faculties are always existent and at a certain stage capable of development. This is important. As above, so below. What exists in the universe at large exists absolutely in the human. All these powers of consciousness are here, are embedded within us. Some are evolved, some are partially evolved, some are still involved and must yet gain expression through a continuing wave of evolution which expresses itself and demands more of us and more of us and more of us as we grow. But these universal faculties exist in each person. We may choose not to develop them. Where they are partially developed, we may discourage and impose on them a kind of atrophy. But fundamentally, all possible knowledge is knowledge within the power of humanity. So if we choose not to grow, we have license to make that choice. And we will stop. We will move around in circles, ever more adamant and ever more defining, because if we choose to be moored in one range of experience, that more and more defines us. I think it is better to have the experience, digest it, and be on the go again, and not to become too comfortable in any posture. No asana is permanent except for the one in the divine consciousness. Seat yourself in the divine consciousness. Back to the paragraph. And since in man there is the inalienable impulse of nature towards self-realization, no struggle of the intellect to limit the action of our capacities within a determined area can forever prevail. I think when we find a soul which is just sort of taking it easy in this life, it's a temporary pause. It's as if you're shifting gears, and you shift from the first gear, going to second, you put it in neutral for a moment, and then you go up higher. And then you put it in neutral again as you come down into third gear. And so these pauses, maybe pauses that refresh and allow us just to take a little time off, but the spirit within us calls us back to work. It isn't incumbent upon us. It is not that the demand from the divine forces us to do it, but there is this inbuilt fire in us, this push of Agni to make progress, that we cannot for long be languid, that we cannot for long be loose. We want to move forward. The next dawn always calls us. And the last sentence of this paragraph. When we have proved matter and realized its secret capacities, the very knowledge which has found its convenience in that temporary limitation must cry to us like the Vedic restrainers, forth now, and push forward also in other fields. Just a word about a word. Sri Aurobindo uses the word proved here as a past participle instead of proven. This is the way Tennyson used it also. And to prove is a verb which is older than simply its geometric application. To prove a theorem. To prove means to learn or to find out by experience. That's its first and original meaning. And then it means to test truth or to test quality. And then it means to establish truth, to determine what is true. So to learn or to find out by experience, when we have proved matter, when we have sounded its depths, in other words, when we have got to the bottom of it and realized its secret capacities, then forth we go, as Sri Aurobindo concludes that sentence. And judging our time, it looks like that we should conclude perhaps our session for tonight as well. So we'll put a mark there. Pardon me, we'll put a mark there. And next week we'll start with the paragraph, If Modern Materialism Were Simply. So, before we wander away from the chapter, though, do you have any questions that you'd like to get cleared up tonight? Send them to me by email.
And you'll draw them out of a hat.
I'll draw them on a blank canvas.
I have a question that relates to the structure of the book itself. These first three chapters, I know we're in two, but the first three chapters, I mean, they just seem to me at the just first, after reading them and looking through the rest of the chapters, they are sort of the groundwork from which everything springs. Is
yes,
right,
exactly right, exactly right. He is, you know the term adumbrate? Adumbrate is a word which means literally to foreshadow. So it was one of Sri Aurobindo's favorite words. These chapters foreshadow, they adumbrate what's going to come next, what's going to come through the rest of the book. So he's established that the first position that he takes is that, yes, all this is for the habitation of the divine. This whole world is an affirmative expression of real being based upon delight, and that we are here to grow, and that we're always going to be looking for light, freedom, immortality. And the satisfactions that will call us to spiritual fruition will call us beyond materialism, will call us beyond the mere gratification of the senses, because there are greater delights. But we want to gratify the body too, because this is the ground of being. This is the first basis. All begins above, but all is present here in this body. And whatever riches that we gain through our inner experience, we have to find expressive tonalities for in our life. We have to use all the colors in the palette to express what life's ultimate values can be. But they are integrative values. They want to unite the above and the below. Whatever is here within us, has been implanted there through a process of involution and must necessarily emerge through evolution. Who is it that carries forward this evolution? Who is this individual? He's an expression of that, but he's also a soul who is a conscious representative of that. And the more he comes to know that, in both senses, then the more perfectly he can express that soul culture in life. He can pour it out, not only in his own world, but in the collective world. And why limit it there? Why not in the entirety of the natural world? So the soul's value changes the way the individual experiences the self, changes the way the individual experiences humanity, changes the way the individual experiences nature, reveals the divine for what it is, but then steps beyond that, because that's only the individual liberation and transformation, and asks that our whole experience of humanity be lifted up into that as well. So we work towards a social transformation, and we work towards that in a way which will bring peace and felicity to all of nature. That we experience nature as the ground of God. And so we take with gratitude what we really need. We don't waste anything, and we do nothing for mindless gratification. We're allowed and permitted to have a rich aesthetic experience of nature, and we're permitted to take what we should, but to have a merely self-indulgent approach to the world is destructive. And when we see humanity acting in that way, it is being driven by ego and desire. And we want to live from soul and divine will rather than from ego and desire. So, namaste. Jai Ma. Mm-hmm.